I wanted to begin today a two-part series on motherhood. And the series will be divided into the two shurim. The first today, a halachic one, and then the second one tomorrow, next week, gets more philosophical, hashkafic, however you'd like to formulate it. And the basic question that I'd like to discuss today is one which one would think is self-evident, but in light of the brachos of modern technology, is actually not at all self-evident, and in fact presents tremendous challenges for poskim and potentially for religious couples. And that is the question of how does halacha define what it means to be a mother? What? Right. Right. If you, right. One possible answer is, if there's a baby crying and you're the one everyone looks at, you're the mother. However, that's a little imprecise, so we may try to get to something a little bit more specific and precise. And what I'm referring to is the question that is referred to nowadays as surrogacy. We took for granted, for most of human history, that a mother is somebody who is producing and contributing the genetic material, obviously the egg, half of the genetic material of the child, but also the person who is hosting, I guess, or carrying, I guess we use the term, the baby, and then actually physically giving birth to the child. And, I think for most of human history, you wouldn't bother even to giving too much thought to that. It's just kind of a given that mother involves both of those. However, modern medicine has created the ability to separate those two. And this is potentially a tremendous bracha because there are two different types of infertility that can be solved by a form of surrogacy. There are women who can produce fertile eggs, but for whatever reason are not able to carry a baby to term. These are women who have many, many miscarriages. So obviously they're able to get pregnant, but if for whatever reason, different conditions can cause this, they can't carry the baby to term. So one solution that's now available from a medical perspective is to extract the egg and the sperm, as I like to say, make the shidduch in the lab, but then to implant that fertilized egg now, not in the wife, but in a third person known as the surrogate who will carry the baby to term. That's potentially a bracha to produce a child that would otherwise most likely not have been able to be given life to. A second version of surrogacy is when a woman herself is infertile. She cannot produce fertile eggs. It could be because of an unfortunate genetic condition. It could be because of age. This happens a lot in the secular world where people tend to deliberately wait to get married. It can happen in our community, but that's usually not because a woman deliberately waited. It's just sometimes people don't find their shidduch until they get older. But either way, if you get married past a certain age, obviously your odds of being able to conceive naturally are much lower. And therefore, there are couples who unfortunately cannot. And therefore, one possible solution that, at least from a medical perspective, could be considered is to use the husband's sperm, a third party's egg, complete stranger potentially's egg, again, make the shidduch in the lab, and then implant that fertilized egg in the wife. So she'll be the one who's carrying the baby to term, she'll be the one who's 9 months and dealing with all the physical stresses of pregnancy, she'll actually give birth, and yet the genetic material will not be hers at all. No one will be the wiser, potentially. Okay, those are two different forms of surrogacy, and two different terms of infertility, which could be solved. So from a strictly medical perspective, this is just a bracha. But on an emotional level, this could be complicated for couples. Not every couple, even who you presented this to as possibility, would even want it. Number one, certainly the latter one. Not every woman would want to carry a baby to term that was not her egg. Some yes, some no, but certainly not everybody. And more for our purposes, the question is, halachically, how do we view this? Not only the secondary question, which is really the one that the shiur is entitled by, which is, in that case, who would be considered the mother? The one who contributed the genetic material? Or the one who carried the baby to term and gave birth? But Secondary question, which we'll get to at the end, although for now we'll just assume that it's not a problem, which is this even allowed halachically? You know, talk about playing God. You know, are there any lines for a from person? Are there, you know, anything that science can do we are allowed to do? Is that true or not? So we'll get to that at the end, but for certainly the most of the shiur, we're going to assume that this is allowed and this is being done. I have no statistics about how common it is in the frum community, but it certainly is sometimes done in the frum community. Now, I want to mention a number of recent scenarios which really highlight, even from a secular perspective, but obviously all the more so from a halachic perspective, the complications. In other words, I you can well imagine, without me needing to elaborate, even if everything goes well, this can be a complicated emotional situation, and we're going to discuss why it's very complicated halachically. But situations don't always go well. So in Israel, just in the last month, there was a very, very high-profile mess-up, which is the nicest way I could put it, in a Suta hospital, where a woman and her husband, a couple, went in for, again, whatever her condition was, I don't know, but she and her husband both produced genetic material. The lab was supposed to make the shidduch and re-implant that in the wife. They did, and she carried the baby to term. And for whatever reason, I think for privacy reasons, we don't know all the details, but they decided to do a DNA test on that baby after the baby was born. And they found out that the woman who gave birth, the wife, it was not her egg. She had no genetic connection whatsoever to that child that she had just given birth to. So this is, needless to say, a massive scandal for the hospital. It is a trauma for the family. And it created a very significant halachic question. And it was all over the news in the last, about a month or so ago when this happened, where Rav David Lau published a letter with a tshuva, poskening who he thought was the real mother in this case. How about a different scenario? Let's assume that we allow this in theory. Are there any limits on how we decide, for example, let's assume that the wife is contributing the egg. Does it matter who is the host mother or the host woman, whatever term you prefer? Are there any guidelines? Is there a preference for Jew versus non-Jew? And are there any people who would be off limits? So just to give you a sense of something that I could never have dreamed of, but again, I'm sure there's an inner logic to it, and I don't think this has ever happened yet in the frum community, or even, I'm not sure, even sure about the Jewish community, but a real-life story from Chicago 7 years ago. There was a woman who had, I think it was cervical cancer. She had some kind of cancer. She basically was not going to be able to carry a baby to term, but she was able to produce eggs. Who was the host? Who was the surrogate? Her mother. And the headlines all over the internet was, grandmother gives birth to daughter's baby. Now, is that really an accurate description of what happened? Why are you assuming she's only the grandmother? Maybe she's the mother. She carried the baby for 9 months and gave birth to it. So it's her daughter's egg. Now, I personally think this is like the weirdest thing ever. But I imagine for all sorts of reasons, you know, you don't have to have, you know, my biases and my baggage. I'm sure these are nice, normal people. They felt, maybe they couldn't find anyone else who would be willing to do it. Maybe it was more meaningful for this woman to have her mother do it. The mother felt she was doing a favor for her daughter. But, you know, is this, you know, Bubby or is this Mommy? Right? Really, really kind of complicated situations. What if, in either case, one of the women isn't Jewish? Does the child need Gerus? I may have mentioned, I'm trying to remember if it was in any of the shiurim we hear here, but I certainly mentioned it once in a shiur, I think, to the men, that many, many years ago, when we still lived in Riverdale, Rabbi Willig called me to be one of the Dayanim on a Beis Din, because there was someone who was not from Riverdale, who Dafka was going to a community far away from where she lived, because this, nobody knew this huge secret. It was the husband, the wife, and their rabbi, and then me and Rabbi Willig, that's the three rabbis of the Beis Din, the only people who knew, her own parents, at least at that point, she had not told. She had her own parents, she would not tell, that this was an older single, she was married, but she didn't get married until her 40s, and it was this huge miracle. Oh my gosh, she conceived, and she's pregnant, it's unbelievable, she finally had a child, what a bracha for this couple. Little did anyone know, only way she was able to conceive was because they took someone else's egg. She was totally infertile. But they used someone else's egg. And they were doing a possible gerut, but in that case, there was a suffix, maybe the person who contributed the egg wasn't Jewish, so does it need a gerus or not, that child, etc. So these are some of the many, many complicated downstream, so to speak, derivative questions that come up, but they really are going to what I'm calling, you know, this very fundamental question from a halachic perspective. Again, we'll do the hashkafic analog, Bezras Hashem, next week, which is, from a halachic perspective, what does it mean to be a mother? How do we define what it means to be a mother? Of course, again, important, but even maybe you could say less important, but certainly all sorts of other important halakha questions. Is there, which mother gets the kibbut av aim? Right? Who are you not allowed to be chutzpahdik to? Right? You know, all sorts of other things. And especially if it's the grandmother and the mother, like, it would be very complicated. Who gets better birthday presents and who has more responsibility for the afikomen? These are very, very big questions.
Can I just ask you what, very quickly? This wasn't around 300 years ago, 400 years ago. This, so who decides the halakha?
That's exactly what we're going to do. Fantastic, Mom. Okay, I want that stated for the record. My mother-in-law and I don't talk outside of the shir, so we didn't coordinate that. No, I'm just kidding. We do talk, but we did not coordinate that. So that's exactly what I want to discuss. This is an example. It's not the only example, but it is an example of a phenomenon which is really, really challenging in the modern era in which you have, more and more, we have technologically capabilities. In this case, it's medicine, but it's not limited to medicine. And these are things which never existed before. Where does a rabbi, where does a posek, where does the community turn to try to figure out the answer to these questions? So in this, in a lot of those scenarios, I'm speaking now more in the luft, we'll bring it down, we're going to bring it down momentarily. So you have to do two creative things. And you will see this again, it could be other shurim we'll give in the future, or other things you learn in other contexts. You are allowed to learn Torah besides Wednesday mornings at 10 o'clock at the Palahniks house. I certainly encourage you to do so, but definitely to learn at 10 o'clock in the mornings at, 10, at the Palahniks. And that is, when you have these kind of cases, you have to be creative in two ways. Number one is you need to look in halachic sources for not identical cases, because they can't possibly exist, but you need to look for cases which at least are similar enough that maybe we can tease out a principle that can be applied. That's a hard work and tricky, but it has to be done if possible. And the second thing, which is maybe more controversial from a legal perspective, legalistic perspective, is to look not at halachic sources, but are there agadic sources? And this is part of a large discussion, which is way beyond just our topic, which is to what extent are stories in the Gemara, stories in the Chumash, stories in Tanakh, if we can find some comparable scenarios, can you bring a halachic proof from a story in the Tanakh, from a story in the Gemara? Usually we would prefer not to do that. Right? If you had a question about the laws of Borer on Shabbos, even if you could find a Medrash or a story, and I don't know, Shmuel Aleph, that seemed to be relevant to what happened, to, you know, what was described, no one would dawn on that, wouldn't dawn on anyone to bring a proof from something like that. Because we have a fertile ground, no pun intended, of halachic sources. And we would never look to a non-halachic source to try to impact a halachic question. But here, where there seems to be no, how could there possibly be halachic sources speaking to the point of a modern medical invention? So we have to be creative in both of those ways. And therefore, I'd like to design the shir exactly as my mother-in-law brilliantly outlined for us. And by first showing many of the modern poskim exactly did what we just described, scoured the agadic and the Tanakh sources for some references, and you'll be shocked that there actually might be some, and then had to be very creative and see if they could find any halachic sources, and then I'll describe to you what I think are the at least four different positions of the modern poskim. So if you take a look now with that long-winded introduction, but I think hopefully important and relevant introduction, let's take a look at source number one. A big locus for this discussion is the birth of none other than Dina. Lots of discussion and mystery shrouding the conception of Dina. So let's start where it's simple. Source number one, Bereishis Perek Lamed. V'achar yolda bas v'tikra es shema Dina. Torah describes the birth of Leah giving birth to Dina. Right? Yaakov has a daughter. Maybe according to Chazal there's more daughters, but there's one that's mentioned in the Torah. Her name is Dina. She's the daughter of Yaakov and which wife? Leah. But Chazal note that there's something peculiar about this text. It begins with a non sequitur, va'achar, and afterwards, Leah gives birth to Dina. After what? What's the context? What are we talking about? So Rashi in Chumash succinctly paraphrases a Gemara, and I gave you have the actual Gemara in source number two, but this is, you'll find a shorter version of this in Rashi on Chumash. Rashi says based on the Gemara, what is achar? Shedana Leia din la'atzma. It was after Leia did a whole chishuv, she made a whole cheshbin in her own mind. She thought of the following. She knew with Ruach HaKodesh, says the Gemara, that there would be 12 shvatim. Yaakov would have 12 sons. At this point, Shisha Yatsu Mimeni. She already had 6. She had given birth to 6. She is the main mother of the shvatim. We know that Yaakov had 2 maidservants. The Arba Minashvachos. Each of them had 2. So now we're up to altogether 10 children, 10 sons that Yaakov has had. 6 from Leah, 4 from the maidservants. Now, says the Gemara, second line, so far Yosef is born. So Rachel, now we're up to 11. So if the last of the Shvatim, number 12, will be born to Rachel, so she's not going to be as prominent as Leah, but at least she's not less than the maidservants, each of whom who had 2. But, says Leah to herself, now I'm pregnant. Number 7. Im Zachar, if I have a boy now, that will be magic number 12 for Yaakov. And lo teheachoti Rachel, ka'achar shvachot. And that will indirectly result in what? Another humiliation for my sister Rachel. She's only going to have 1 child, only 1 son, because I'll have now had the 7th, and that'll be it for Yaakov having sons. And she'll even be less than a maidservant. And that bothered her as a sister. She felt bad. I already have 6. I don't need a 7th. My sister should at least have 2. She shouldn't be humiliated less than the maidservants. Says the Gemara, a miracle took place. Miyad nehepcha labas. In fact, Leah was carrying a male child. But because of this exquisite sensitivity that she had to her sister, she davens to Hashem, and Hashem makes a miracle and transforms that child, that fetus, into a girl. And that's Dina. And when the Chumash says with one little word, the Achar, after what? After all that. Okay? Now that is fascinating. But if that's all true, it's got nothing to do with our topic. Unless you know of anybody who had, you know, they went to the sonogram and they said, oh, that's a boy, and then they gave birth to a girl. Who knows? Maybe the technician made a mistake. Or maybe they davened to Hashem and there was a miracle. You never know. Okay? But not really relevant to our topic. However, there are other opinions in Chazal about what happened with Dina, which are even more wild than what we just saw. Take a look at the Targum Yonasan, source number 3. Same thing. Leah's pregnant. She's nervous for her sister. She davens to Hashem, so it shouldn't be unfair. But what happens? Says the Targum, source number 3. Vayishma Hashem es tefilas Leah. She hears it. V'nechlefu ha'ubrim b'mei ehem. According to the Targum, Rachel and Leah, the 2 sisters, this has happened in many families, 2 sisters are pregnant at the same time. And initially, Leah was supposed to have a boy. Not when I say supposed to, I mean she was carrying a male child. Rachel was carrying a girl. But because of the sensitivity to Leah, davening to Hashem, it wasn't, like we saw in the first version, that the fetus in Leah just transformed into a girl, but rather, whoop! Somehow, cosmically, they transferred. And the girl that was in Rachel ends up being implanted into Leah, and she gives birth to Dina. And the boy that had been in Leah, whoop! Gets transferred somehow, cosmically, I don't know what the right adjective would be, into Rachel. And she gives birth to Yosef, and now she's able to have 2 sons. And now, at least her dignity is protected. She doesn't have less than the maidservants. Wow. Now, where would you possibly get this from? So again, it sounds wild, and it is wild, no denial. But there is an interesting textual pshat. I wouldn't say proof is too strong a word, but a hint. Or it might support this, which is in source number 4. Take a look. This is an example of just one of the children that's born to Leah. But in all the children in general, you may recognize this for this terminology. It's very familiar in these coming weeks' parshios, where the Torah says, "Vatahar od Leah, vatelid ben shishil Yaakov." With all of the other children, it says, "Vatahar." What does Vatahar mean? She conceived. She conceived, then she gave birth. But go back to source number 1. Look what it says about Leah giving birth to Dina. It never mentions she conceived Dina. It only mentions that she gave birth to Dina. But all of the six sons that Leah gave birth to, the Torah goes out of its way to say she conceived and she gave birth. The one differential, the one discrepancy is Dina. It just says that Leah gave birth to Dina. It never says she conceived. So says the Targum, and maybe this works for the Gemara too, as crazy as this all sounds, and this is wild medrash, but I have a good pshat question. How come it never says that Leah conceived Dina? And the answer, according to the Chazal, would be what? Because she didn't. Some miracle happened post-conception, which allowed Leah to give birth to Dina. Now, if you kind of just let your mind contract after it just exploded, let's bring it back to normal. What matters to us is not all the wild midrashim. What matters to us at the moment is, what does this say for us? And if the second version is right, then we have a miraculous paradigm of what has basically become now a medical and scientific procedure. Right? Some woman contributed the genetic material. According to the second version, who contributed the genetic material for Leah? Up to me. The genetic material for Dina? Rachel. She conceived Dina. But through the miracle of the prayer of Leah, somehow, and in the Medrash, in Chazal, it was somehow miraculously implanted. But medically, we would say, no, in that case, Rachel would just go to the doctor, take out the fertilized egg, and implant it in her sister in Leah. The same process happened. Instead of being, you know, the overt hand of God, it may be the overt hand of the doctor, you know, and the invisible hand of God. But basically, we have a biblical model now for surrogacy, or at least separating what we heretofore would have thought was impossible. Can you separate the genetic mother and the birth mother? According to these Mefarshim, Dina is the first example in human history of such a thing. Genetic mother was Rachel, and the birth mother is Leah. Now, if that's the case, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but if that's the case, so now what's the multi-million dollar question? Well, who's the real mother? And that's exactly what we need to know. This is what the family at Kasuta Hospital needed to know. Who's the real halachic mother? So here, let's see, what does the Torah itself do? And what is astounding is that here also it's confusing. Not only do you have different midrashim about Dina, so we don't know if this is relevant or not, there's different indications in the Chumash about who was Leah's real mother. On the one hand, going back to source number one, it does say that Leah gave birth to Dina. Okay, but does that mean that Leah is really the halachic mother? We don't necessarily know. That's now the question. Until now, we thought it was obvious that Leah is the mother, but now it's not so obvious. So source number six, we have later in Sefer Bereishis, Parshas Vayishlach, Nebuch, we know. One of the only things we know from the Chumash itself about Dina is that very tragically, she's raped. And the Torah tells us, Vateitze Dina bas Leah. As the Torah describes the story of Leah being Dina being kidnapped and raped, the Torah goes out of its way to describe her as the daughter of Leah. So it sounds like, if we had just this pasuk, the Torah seems to be saying, the birth mother is the mother. Even though the genetic material was from Rachel. But Leah gave birth to her, and therefore Leah is the mother. She's Bas Leah. Okay. However, there is another medrash, which probably most people don't know, even though it's in Rashi, and it's also wild, and it makes it not so clear even about Dina in that regard. How so? Take a look at source number seven, much later, in the end of Bereishis. We're describing now, summing up the genealogy of the family of Yaakov. So we know that one of Yaakov's sons, of course, one of the Shvatim, is Shimon. And the Torah tells us in source number seven, who are Shimon's sons? So all sorts of names that we haven't heard in a long time, except for perhaps Ohad. Yemuel, Yamin, Ohad, Yochin, Tzochar. And then Shaul, that's a pretty familiar name. But here, shockingly and totally uncharacteristically, the Torah tells us who the mother was. Right? We don't say who the mother was for all of Shimon's other children. We don't say who his wife was. Did he have multiple wives? Did he have maidservants? Who were the mothers of all these other boys? The Torah doesn't bother to tell us. But it tells us about Shaul. Who is he? We know he's the son of Shimon, but who else is he? Ben Haknanit. Whoa. So first of all, we have a reference to the mother, which we don't usually have. And it's not, you know, Rachel Mindel. Wasn't the girl who went to be... It's a non-Jewish woman. A Knanit? Shimon married a Knanit? And that's who gave birth to this boy, Shaul. That's not Shaul HaMelech, by the way, just the same name. Don't get confused. Okay, what's going on? Why are we telling us this? And who's this Knanit? So Rashi, you see there in the parentheses, Rashi tells us an astounding story. HaKnanit refers to Dina. Dina married Shimon. And they had a child named Shaul. Now, why would Dina marry Shimon? We'll get that in a second. And why was Dina referred to pejoratively, or even if it's not pejoratively, just so anonymously, as HaKnanit? Just say Dina. Why are we calling Dina HaKnanit? So look at Rashi. This boy, Shaul, is Ben Dina, who is referred to as HaKnanit. Why? Shenivala L'Kanani. She had been raped by a Canaanite, by Shechem, by Hamor. She had been raped by people from Canaan. Now that we know why she's being referred to as that, but why would she marry Shimon? What's the story behind this? And why does the Torah need to tell us this? So it's actually both tragic and touching. Kishahargu Eshchem Lahaisadina Rotza Lotzes. Right? There's so much. I mean, again, all of Bereishis, every story is just so amazing. Again, if we just do it, you know, again, it's very nice to, you know, get a little Dvar Torah from our kids at the Shabbos table, but if that's the only thing we ever do about Sefer Bereishis, we're missing so much. There's so much, you know, beautiful and rich, sophisticated things, which really only as adults we could appreciate. Think about that story, right? Dina is kidnapped, she's raped, then her brothers come in, they kill the city, and they save her. That's a great story. It could be definitely made into a movie. Hollywood would never make it because they don't like to make movies that show Jews being strong. Israel being strong, that doesn't sell, or at least doesn't sell in certain parts of the world. But it could be a movie for sure, right? And it's really wild because the only thing the Torah does tell us as the postscript is that Yaakov was upset. And there's obviously so much question and drama, which the Torah itself leaves very unclear. Why was Yaakov upset? Who was right? Yaakov or the brothers? But that's all we hear. Then it's like over, right? Don't you think? Now, on a human level, if we ever would bother to think about it, we could imagine this was traumatic for Dina, right? The whole family had a rupture now with the father being upset at the sons. What was Dina's relationship with Yaakov after this? I mean, these are all things the Torah doesn't tell us about. But what happened to Dina? How did she recover from this? So of all things that we might have guessed, I think the one thing we never would have guessed is what Rashi just told us. Rashi says, when the brothers, you know, so to speak, imagine, you know, again, if you imagine, I don't know, some like, you know, World War II or a Vietnam movie that you ever saw, where like the army came in, the good guys came in, they liberated a POW camp, or they liberated the camps, right? The concentration camps, right? And the good guys, the soldiers, they come and they go into the barracks and say, "You're free! You can come home with us now." So what happened? The brothers kill all of Shechem, and they find the hut or wherever, the pit, wherever, I don't know, wherever they were keeping Dina locked up. And they say, "Good news, we just killed everybody. You're free. You can come back with us." Says Rashi, Dina didn't want to go. "I'm not going. What is there for me there?" Says Dina, "Who's going to marry me?" Now, from our more modern Western perspective, this may be particularly hard to hear. But it doesn't take that much of imagination to understand where Dina is coming from, since in much of the world in 2022, this is still the case. Right? A woman who is raped, it is basically considered her fault. It's a shame to the family, and she'll never get a shidduch, and it ruins the whole family. You hear about these stories, again, thank God not in our world. We have enough of our own problems. This is not one of them. But you hear about stories happening not 2,000 years ago. You hear about stories happening now of fathers, Rachmana Litzlan, killing their daughters. For what big crime? They were raped, and it's going to ruin the family. So leave that horrible postscript of that story out. But what's the premise? The premise is that to be a woman who's raped is such a badge of shame. "Who's going to marry me?" she says. "What did you didn't do me a favor. At least here I'm being taken care of by this wealthy mafioso. Now you killed him. Great. Now what? I'm just a stigmatized woman who was kidnapped and raped. Not so great on the Beis Yaakov Shidduch resume." So says the Rashi, as a result, she only left Ad Shenishba LaShimon Shiyasena. So Shimon, who was one of the brothers who was there, says, "Come, I'll marry you. I'll take care of you." Wow. They don't teach that in elementary school. I think they might skip that, Rashi. It's the only one who's told me that at my Shabbos table. So that, says Rashi, is what happened with Dina. So as a result, Dina marries Shimon. Okay, that's it's a tragic story. It adds a whole level. The simple shot in the Chumash is already tragic enough for Dina. But we probably don't think about this whole other dimension, the emotional and psychological trauma and what it meant for her future, and she was worried about it, even in the moment. Very raw, very, very real, very human. Okay, but now, and that's the tragic part of the story, and the touching part of the story is Shimon stepping up, saying, I'll take care of you. I'll be there for you. They get married. She can have a semblance of a normal life, and she even becomes a mother. Fine. Comes along the tour source number 8 and says, hold on! Stop! Stop! Stop filming. This movie is great, but I'm telling you, some rabbi is going to go to the movie theater. He's going to say, this can't be true, because it's against halacha. How can Shimon marry Dina, their brother and sister? They're both the children, not only of Yaakov, they're both the children of Leah. Shimon is one of Leah's children. How can they marry each other? It's usur, it's incest. So says the Torah, source number 8. I'll tell you how it makes sense. Well, if you have medrash, asi shapir, shikah herayon shel Dina haya, bebeten shel Rachel. Says the Torah, this is a proof. It must be what's the correct pshat? That who's the real mother? Actually, Rachel. So it's true, they're half siblings on the father's side. But the Torah assumes, and now we're not going to get into the weeds about the laws of incest and primatan Torah and non-Jews. But from a for our perspective, it just matters what the Torah does with this. Says the Torah, you see, this is a proof. The only reason Dina was allowed to marry Shimon is because they actually weren't fully siblings. They had different mothers. What do you mean they had different mothers? Wasn't Dina given birth to by Leah? Yes, but it was an egg, a genetic material that came from Rachel. And evidently you see from this that who's the real mother? Not the birth mother, but the genetic mother. So all we've done so far is just talk about Dina. And there is voluminous material and confusion about Dina, but it could be, just to clarify where we are so we can now go to step 2 of this year, there's different versions of, everyone agrees there was something wild with Dina's conception and birth. The only question is how wild and which exact version. One of the versions is that this is a model for surrogacy, because really the genetic material is from Rachel and Leah gave birth. Right? That's only one version, but according to that version, that is very, very similar and parallel to what we would consider now modern day surrogacy. Point number one. Point number two is a major discussion with conflicting evidence. It's not so simple for us, ladies. It's not just some easy, oh, look in the Chumash or look in a few Mefarshim and now we know the answer. Because there's conflicting evidence. On the one hand, some sources refer to Dina as Bas Leah, but this whole wild story as the postscript to Dina's kidnapping and rape maybe indicates that she's not really Bas Leah, but she's really Bas Rachel. So we have some evidence and fascinating material to study, but we don't yet have any clear hachra, any clear guidance. Yeah.
According to the switch, it kind of goes against why Yaakov loved Yosef so much. Yaakov loved Yosef because it was Rachel's son.
Uh-huh.
There was a switch.
Right.
Yosef was really Leah's son.
Right. If you go by the genetics, right.
If Yosef would been Binyamin who was switched.
It says, so according to this version, it says it was Yosef. I thought it was Binyamin, but I may have misremembered. Yeah, because we saw the... if you take a look at source number 3, he says it was Yosef. Okay. Anyway, what... There's... Now that we finished the Tanakh, we know that the Gemara itself is a mixture of halacha and agada. And in the Gemara, there are two haggadic sources, but I'll let you in on a preview. They conflict. Okay? But they're still fascinating. Number one, source number 9, is the Gemara Nida, a Gemara you are familiar with, whether you've previously seen it inside or not, but you're probably familiar with it. The famous notion of there are three partners in every child. Shlosha Shutvin Yesh Ba'adam. Right? The father, the mother, and the silent partner, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right, guiding that sperm, guiding that egg to make sure that we actually have conception. But the Gemara doesn't just say that. That's how it's like often quoted. The Gemara actually gets more, you could say, graphic or specific, and tries, again, this is very, very, unsophisticated or unmodern science, but the Gemara is trying, as it can in its day and age, to try to describe which genetic material, which parts of a child come dafka from the sperm, which come dafka from the egg, and which come dafka from Hashem. So the Gemara starts giving examples. Well, the father is the white in the baby, whether in the eyes or the skin, and that's also what gives the bones and the nails, and the mother is again, the egg is referred to as Odem, which is from there, that's where the actual flesh comes from, and skin, and maybe the black part of the eye, the iris, and Hashem, of course, gives the neshama, and the vision of the image of the face. The details are not important. But what do you see from this Gemara? How is it, what is the frame of reference for motherhood here? Purely genetic. Parallel to a father, right? As everyone in this room, especially everyone but me, will attest, father ain't doing anything those 9 months afterwards. Right? The father's job was over at conception from that perspective. Hopefully for the rest of the child's life, the father's very involved. But it's not an equal partnership between husband and wife. Right? It can be equal at the moment of conception, but after that it's all on the wife. And yet in this Gemara, it doesn't talk at all about, I carried the baby for 9 months, I gave birth to the baby, I had a 14-hour labor, the epidural didn't work. None of that's in the Gemara. The Gemara just says, this genetic material comes from the father. And when did that happen? At the moment of conception. Right? The father's not involved biologically after that. And this genetic material came from the mother. So it sounds like everything we're talking about here is genetic material. A genetic mother. The egg. On the other hand, source number 10, who is one of the other great tragic heroines that we usually don't think about? Esther. Now, we think about Esther all the time. And I think I made this point maybe in last year's pre-perm shiur or in 2 years ago pre-perm shiur, right? Every time you see those million of young, delicious, beautiful, little cute girls dressing up as Esther on Purim, if you know a little bit more about the story, it's unbelievably ironic. There's very few women in all of Jewish history who had a worse life than Esther. She had her moment of glory, and for that she's appreciated and heralded for all of history. But as some, again, depending on which medrash, either as a very young girl or at least as a young wife, she's taken away to the palace of Ahasuerus. She has, again, this moment of glory where she saves the Jewish people, but she's basically a prisoner who with some level, you know, of regularity is raped by Ahasuerus. And then the story ends and the Jews of Shushan lived happily ever after. Whatever happened to Esther? What do you think? I'm scared to do it. Ask your child, what happened to Esther at the end of the Megillah? Don't do it, right? You'll ruin it for them. She never leaves. Her life is one big tragedy. She has to stay with Ahasuerus. She never leaves. Okay? So that's the tragedy of the end of her life. But what did Chazal say was the tragedy of the beginning of her life? She didn't just have it hard in the end. She had it hard in the beginning too. Says Rashi, the Gemara Megillah, you all know this Rashi, you probably all know, when the Megillah refers to Esther as Ein La'av Ve'Aim, what do you mean she didn't have a father and a mother? So it's bad enough if at some point when she was a kid, both of her parents died. That would be bad enough. She was a Yosom. She was an orphan. But Chazal say it was worse than that. She didn't live 1 second of 1 minute of 1 day with either a mother or a father. Says the Gemara, how so? Because after the mother became pregnant, after she conceived, the father died. Right? This happens every now and then, just statistically, of course it happens. It's obviously tragic. A young father dies while his wife is pregnant. And she gives birth as a widow. Right? Very sad, but it could happen. Bad enough. But then, says Rashi, what happened? When did Esther's mother die? In childbirth. So from the moment she's born, says the Gemara, Rashi's quoting this, I should say, Nimsa Shlohayla Av Misha Shinira Lahakros Av. From the moment that you could be called a father, she didn't have a father. Now, when's the moment you could be called a father? When she became pregnant, when they conceived. And apparently, right afterwards is when the father died. And now, continues Rashi, Ukashi Yeld Data Ima. And when the mother gave birth, the mother died. Velonirit Likrot Aim. And therefore, the mother, whoever that was, Mrs. whatever her name was, she never had the ability, lo nirit likrot aim. She was never called, she never had the ability to ever be a mother. Now, 1 second. If you hold that being the genetic mother, the one who produces the egg, makes you the halachic mother, again, on a human level, of course, it's tragic to hear about a woman dying in childbirth. Of course, that's tragic. But would it be accurate to say, according to that, that this anonymous woman never was a mother? She was a mother for the 9 months she was carrying the baby to term. If you hold that being the genetic mother is the mother. It sounds like that Rashi is explaining based on the Gemara that what? That when do you become a mother? Only at birth. And then Nebuch, since this woman died in childbirth, she never was a mother. But if you feel that the genetic mother is the mother, again, I'm not taking away the human tragedy. Of course, there's a human tragedy to die in childbirth. But at least for 9 months, she was a mother. But that's not what Rashi said. Rashi said she was never a mother. So this, the story of Esther implies, according to Chazal, that we go by the birth mother. But the previous Gemara about the three partners implies that it's the genetic mother. And therefore, we are back to where we started, which is confused. Because just like the story with Dina didn't seem to give a fascinating discussion but didn't prove anything, these agadic sources also seem to be conflicting. Okay? So now, let's see if we could find some halachic sources. What halachic sources will help us? And you could look high, you could look low, you could spend 2,711 days learning Daf Yomi and go through all of Shas. You will not find the word surrogacy in the Gemara. Okay, I saved you that effort. Because it didn't exist. Of course it didn't exist. So what's the closest thing that we can find? Fascinating. Conversion. How does conversion relate to surrogacy? Imagine a pregnant woman who converts. Now, there's only one woman who is the genetic mother and the birth mother. Like, we get that. But from a halachic perspective, this woman has two different identities. If she conceived before she converted, and she converted during her pregnancy, she conceived as a non-Jew. I'm just making up a name. Latoya. I'm just trying to figure out some name that no one here possibly would have on their American passport, okay? If I still got that one wrong, it's not on me. It's on your parents. Yeah, I was going to say like Karen or something, but I don't know, maybe someone's name is Karen. Like, I don't want to go there, right? I don't know why that popped in my head, but then I said, no, I'm not going to go there. Latoya. She was Latoya. And now by the time she gave birth as Leah. Because Mitindrinan in the 5th month, she converted. So you now have, from a halachic perspective, one person conceived, one person gave the genetic material, and a different halachic person gave birth. Now, I'm stressing that because there's a halachic principle, I should have mentioned it a moment ago, which is, there's a rule in halacha, that when you convert, ger, kakatan halonol adami. Not just, is it like, you know, rebirth, the way other religions sometimes talk about, you know, people finding God, but from a halachic perspective, we view a convert as being reborn. Like a new baby. It's the term of the Gemara. Ger katkatan hanola dami. We view that person now as a newborn child. We erase their past. They start now from zero. So, Latoya conceived. And now a new person called Leah gave birth. So it's not exactly, obviously it's not exactly a situation that we've been describing of a surrogate, but it's at least somewhat parallel. So in that case, how would we? Is she? Who's the mother, Latoya or Leah? And now I'll make it more complicated, but this will be very interesting. Let's say there are siblings. Let's say Latoya was pregnant with twins, and then Leah gives birth to the twins. Are the twins considered brothers or not?
No.
Okay, so here's the question. Very good. So now we can see where the Gemara... So take a look at the Gemara source number 11. Says the Gemara, Toshma, let's hear a case. Shnei achim t'umim gerim. There are two brothers who are twins. Now, how could there be brothers who are... twins, I should say, who are converts? This is the context, right? Achim t'umim gerim. Twin brothers who are converts. So you take a look where it's underlined at the end of the line. The Gemara says, what's the case? Our case, Haisa horosan shelo b'kedusha, the conception happened before she converted, when she was still Latoya, but leidasan b'kedusha, but when she gave birth, the leida, the birth, she was already b'kedusha, she was already Jewish, she was Leah. So the Gemara is discussing now, what's the status of those two boys? So the Gemara says, the part that's relevant for us, chayavin mishum eshes ach. The halacha is that a brother is never allowed, unless it would be Yibum, so what became Asur becomes a mitzvah. But other than Yibum, a brother is never allowed to marry his sister-in-law. Even if his brother dies, or anything like that, assuming there were children, it's not a Yibum situation, or they got divorced, it doesn't matter. Somebody who was your brother's wife, right? I know these things happen like on the Jerry Springer show or something like that. If you get the reference, good. If not, you should consider yourself blessed. that you don't know the shmutz that used to exist or still exists in America. But it was always some... The reason I have an excuse of knowing that is when I was a kid, he was a respectable human being. He was the mayor of Cincinnati when I was growing up, and then the news person on the NBC affiliate news. He was and he grew up in Washington Heights as a nice traditional Jew. Then he decided to, you know, become Jerry, all the crazy stuff. Okay, so this case, are you allowed to marry your sister-in-law? The halacha is no. Eishes ach is usher. But says the Gemara about our case, the twins who were conceived by Latoya, but birthed by Leah, mechayvin mishum eishes ach. They are also prohibited from each other's wives. In other words, what are we viewing them as? Brothers.
That's what. They be brothers? I don't understand.
Oh, so let me explain. I will explain.
Latoya or Leah, but either way, they're brothers.
The answer is because what happens when you convert? We erase the past. So if we would go by just what happened genetically, so for 5 months, genetically, they're considered siblings. But what happens when she converted? They're not siblings. Because everything started from scratch then, and the thing that had happened, which would have connected them, the genetics, gets erased. If we're assuming that they are children... that they are siblings and therefore they're prohibited from each other's wives. A number of posters say this Gemara indicates that who's the real mother? Leah, the birth mother. Meaning to say birth, in this case, is one woman. So it's a little bit confusing. But birth, let's just, to be more clear for the next case as well, I want to talk about which mother, but which moment is critical determining motherhood? If we're assuming that they have a prohibition and they're viewed halakhically as brothers, this would indicate that what? That birth. Now, the birth is the key moment. And when these two brothers were born, they were born to a Jewish mother. They were born to Leah. They're twins like every other Jewish group set of twins are twins and are brothers and are siblings. If we would consider conception the key point, the problem is that when she converted, not want to say it's not a problem, but then when she converted, that would have been wiped off the record and they'd be basically considered strangers. The only way they can be considered brothers, or this Gemara it would seem, implies that the birth is the critical moment. Yeah.
So they don't have to convert either.
Oh, that's the next Gemara. Good. So now let's look at, that's one Gemara. Now let's look at source number 12. The Gemara says, Nachrit Muberet Shinit Gaira. Now, this is more and less complicated. It's less complicated, there's no more twins. Latoya has one, gets pregnant, she has one child developing inside of her, and now she converts and becomes Leah. And she gives birth to Menachem Mendel. Does Menachem Mendel need to go to the mikveh or not? Says the Gemara, no. Nochris muberish in his gaira, bina ein tzarach tefila. Now the Gemara gets into a whole complicated discussion. Why not? He was conceived as a non-Jew. So, and what would you say that the mother going to the mikveh for her tefila, part of the conversion process is to go to the mikveh? So was her conversion process effective on him? How could that be? Isn't that, to put it mildly, a machitza? If you're worried about a little fleck of nail polish, or maybe I forgot to take off a ring, here you have somebody who's completely encased in the womb of the mother. How is that a mikvah? There's a major chatzitza. That water didn't go anywhere near the baby. That's the Gemara's problem. So the Gemara answers, last two words, Hainu Rabise. The considering that the a chatzitza is not just something and how big is it, it's something that's not really a part of you, right? That's why it is chotzitz, whether it's nail polish or maybe a band-aid and the whole shayla of a scab or a temporary filling. All of those things are not you. They're not naturally a part of you. Rabise says this is the natural place where's the fetus supposed to be? This is its natural habitat at the moment. And your natural habitat is not a chatzitza, only natural things, artificial things that are connected to you. So technically speaking, the Gemara has a whole discussion, but the bottom line is the mother is not a chatzitza, and therefore when she jumps into the mikvah, mazel tov, what gets implied? That there are two conversions happening. The mother and the child. Well, one second. This is not good. Because why would this whole shaila, the whole discussion where was the mikvah, what happened to the chatzitza, and then we give this answer that we just gave. But what's the assumption of the whole question and answer? That the child needed to be converted, but the conversion of the mother counts for the child because the womb is not a chatzitza. But what's the what would you ask on the Gemara? What's better than that? What's better than saying the mother's conversion helped for the child? Say better, that the child didn't need conversion because it was born from a Jewish mother. Leah gave birth to Menachem Mendel. If all we care about is the moment of birth, when was Mendel born? After Latoya became Leah. Mendel is born to a Jewish mother. And then the real answer is, the Mendel wouldn't have needed Geirus because Mendel's Jewish. You didn't need Geirus and I need Geirus because we're born from a Jewish mother. The fact that the Gemara schwitzes and kvetches and figures out how the mother's mikvah counts for the child, assume that it needed to count. Well, why does it need to count if we go by the moment of birth? This Gemara applies that it doesn't go by birth, but it goes by the moment of conception. And since Latoya conceived this baby, just like Latoya needed to convert, the baby would need to convert. Mazel Tov, says the Gemara, the mom's conversion counts. But the very fact that it needed to count implies that we go by conception. Now, you'll say, okay, but didn't we just get through saying source number 11 that Gemara implied that the reason that the brothers are considered brothers, the twins are considered brothers, because we go not by conception, but by birth. So one Gemara sounds like it's birth, one Gemara sounds like it's conception. Oy vavoy. We still are confused. We still have no real guidance. Now, because it's late, I'm going to skip source number 13. Source number 13 is a fascinating attempt, and there's even others. This, way before there was the medical possibility or a shaila going on in the Orthodox community about who's the real mother in surrogacy, great Rabbanim were dealing with these Gemaras just from a theoretical perspective. What do you think guys do in yeshiva all day? Not everything is about, you know, cutting-edge cases. But there are all sorts of contradictions in the Gemara, and people are schwitzing and figuring out how to resolve contradictions. So way before this was even relevant for practical, you know, surrogacy, you know, and fertility and halacha questions, great poskim, certainly in the early 20th century, there's quite a few who were just trying to understand the Gemara seems to contradict itself. Not which mother is the real mother. If you would have asked the rabbi 100 years ago, he didn't understand the question. How could it be, what are you doing? My mother's the one who gives birth. And but what they were aware of is what moment does the woman become the mother? Does she become a mother at conception, or does she become a mother at birth? And that's the question of Geirus. When did this woman become the mother? While she was still Latoya when she conceived, or when she became Leah and she gave birth? And here we seem to have a contradiction in Gemaras. So various poskim try to understand and resolve that contradiction. But at the end of the day, there's a theme emerging. What's the theme? We don't seem to have conclusive proof. Stories about Dina can be proven one way or the other. Other agadic Gemaras proven one way or the other. These two halachic Gemaras, one implies birth, one implies genetics. We're left with a decent amount of evidence, maybe more than we would have thought of at the start of this year, but none of it conclusive. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with a lot of machlokas. Take a look at source number 14. So if you want to keep track, if you want to count on your fingers and your toes, let's see how many different positions exist now. Number one, a very, very well-known and prominent position, here I quoted it in the name of Rav Yashiv, is Haisha Hayoledes Hi Haim. We go by the birth mother, not the person who contributed the genetic material. So for example, if this is correct, in the case that I told you about when I was in Riverdale, even though the genetic material may have been from a Russian Ola in Israel, and the family sneaked to Israel, had the procedure done, came back to America, I want to be more specific than that, and all of a sudden everyone thinks, wow, it's a miracle, this 40-something-year-old newlywed now is pregnant, Baruch Hashem, but it's not really her egg, but according to this, but she is the mother. And even if the egg donor was not Jewish, it wouldn't matter, because who's the mother? The mother who gave birth, and the mother who gave birth is this nice, firm woman. This is the position of Rav Yashiv, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, and in case one were wondering, 5-6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, in that case in Kasuto in hospital, when Rabbi David Lau came out with a big psak on the name of the Rabbanut, he said the same thing. That the birth mother is the mother. It's chaval that they messed up in the lab, to put it mildly. But halachically, the birth mother is the mother. That's one opinion. Source, okay, if you're keeping track, that's number one. Number two. There's a whole encyclopedia of halacha and medicine. How do you say that in Hebrew? Encyclopedia Hilchati Rufait. Rufuit. Okay, by Avram Steinberg, who was one of the great medical ethicists and from experts in the field to this day. So he, in source number 15, points that there are others who disagree. And they believe that both father and mother are defined the same way. There's a parallelism in halacha between fatherhood and motherhood. V'hainu shneihem nikva'im mehazra'a v'hatipa rishona. Just like a father is defined by who he contributed the genetic material in the sperm, a mother is defined in a parallel way by contributing the genetic material in the egg. And in the footnote there, he mentions that Rav Goren had this position. A number of contemporary Israeli authorities agree with this as well. Rav Yaakov Ariel from Ramat Gan. There was a famous story that was written up by one of the Talmidim of the Gush. That Rav Lichtenstein ruled this way. There was a couple the woman could conceive, but she couldn't carry the baby to term. So they took the woman's egg, the wife's egg, a nice firm woman, a nice firm guy. They were married, they fertilized it, and then they had somebody else carry the baby. When that host surrogate mother gave birth, now they have a little baby, and I think they moved to another community. So they showed up with a baby. So no one in the neighborhood, I think actually had triplets, which is very common in fertility procedures. There was actually multiple births. I think it was two boys and a girl, or two girls and a boy. Anyway, the point is, they show up in the community, no one knows the wiser. Father's a Kohen. Is this baby who was carried to term by a host, stranger, so is this considered now a normal, is a chal? What's the status of this baby?
He's
Yisrael. So Rav Lichtenstein ruled that he could be treated as a Kohen and Kadochen. Isn't that amazing? Okay, again, it's late.
Why would he
The bottom line is, what, based on what? That he said we go by the genetics. And there's the people who he calls Ab and Ima, halachically, about 6 weeks ago, whenever it was, that the Kasuto thing was happening, completely coincidentally, I think it was the Erev Shabbos Noach, some of you may remember we advertised it, Rabbi Willig happened to be in Israel, and he gave a guest shiur in our shul, and because Puruvu comes up in Noach, he spoke about IVF, he didn't speak about it, and he didn't even know, I said to him, it's so funny you're speaking about the topic, there's just this big scandal in Israel. So he actually used the first 5 minutes of that shiur just to mention in 5 minutes what we just spent an hour doing, and he went on record, which I knew anyway was his opinion. He disagrees with the chief rabbinate. He also holds that it's the genetic mother, not the birth mother. Okay, so that's position number two. Now you think, well, where else could it be? The whole shul only had two options. Ah, come on. Ye of little faith. Source number 16. Rav Shterbach. Menachem Mendel has two mommies. They're both the mothers. At least me suffolk. And he talks about a case if you have one of the mothers isn't Jewish, right? Again, you could have a host mother being not Jewish, or you could have the egg donor being not Jewish. Either way, in his case, he says, "Leniastaiti mu'urav bo Yehudia v'goya." This child is a blend, and therefore we'll have also to chumras lahalacha. So we usually think that it's not a Jewish thing to say so and so has two mommies, but according to Sternbach and some others, Rabbi Bleich, those of you know Rabbi Bleich in New York. Also as machmir, that maybe that we have to view this person as having two mothers. Okay, next. Source number 17. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. So he says, I don't know if there's, say, two mothers. He says, basically, we just have to be honest and be humble and say, we don't know. So Shlomo, I don't know. Ein ledato raya brura ledavar kedei lechri miyayim. He says, I don't know. He could learn the sugi as well as you and I, to put it mildly. He didn't come up with an answer either. And therefore, practically speaking, he also thinks maybe we have to be machmir in all directions. I don't know. And what else is left for us? What's the fourth possibility? At least in one of his tshuvas, Sitz Eliezer, Psalm 18. Any child that kal hi ra'on nase gamkein b'mivchana, anywhere where this was a kind of a IVF kind of situation where the conception, all that stuff happens in a lab. Ki'ilu hu yaso me'av v'gam eim yachad.
Wow.
No mother. He also says perhaps no father, if the conception happened that way. But for our purposes, it says there could be no mother. Mother may need both. And if you separate them, now I'm not saying that that's the mainstream view. I'm just telling you there are at least all four possibilities you could have imagined exist. And this is a massive machlokas. If somebody on the likes of Shlomo Zalman Orbach could say, I have no idea, who could really be sure? And therefore, it's not a surprise, source number 19, and this is, I gave you from this written source of Rav Yashin and Rav Shlomo Zalman, but it's not limited to them. Bottom line, and some of you may know about cases like this, the bottom line is, I think this is the consensus, Given the massive confusion in the poskim, from a halachic perspective, none of this would be recommended. In the Hasidic world, this is considered totally usur and verboten. Some of you may know there are some wonderful organizations in New York, A Time, and what's the other one? There's two. What's the other one? Boni Olam. I believe they're both Hasidic, and I know couples who have gone to both who tried everything, and Boni Olam and A Time, if you ever help them, they will not help you for money or anything else if you want to do surrogacy, because their poskim hold it's usur. We don't get involved in these kind of things. There's a limit. Most other poskim outside the Hasidic world will allow it, but pretty much everyone, again, I don't think this is such a controversial thing to say, because I think most couples would not be running to surrogacy either as their first choice. But even if a couple would theoretically want to run to it, as you see here from Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Yashiv, and I've heard the same thing from Rabbi Willing and others, you never would recommend a couple to do this if they haven't desperately tried everything else, and then are really, 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 really strongly passionate that they want to do this, because you're getting into such a no man's land in a twilight zone. Halachically, it is so, so confusing. Again, I think most poskim, certainly my rabbonim, when it's really, really necessary, they've tried and exhausted every other effort, would allow it. And Machon Pua in Yerushalayim does get involved in this. And the real musar you see from that Kasuto story is, if you're from and you do this, and even if you're not from, you should do this, you need to have a mashkiach. And if you do anything through Pua, and in Israel, it's much easier than in Israel, although you can do this in America, you pay, but then the kupot actually reimburse you, most if not all of it. Every step of the way, from the moment they extract the genetic material to the reimplantation, everything is with, not from the lab in the hospital, but a third party from Pua, a mashkiach, or often a mashkicha, making sure that everything is correct so we don't ever have these situations. But even if you don't have the mix-up, still, one person contributed the egg, one person gave birth. Who's the real mother? It is so confusing halachically that, again, if there's any way to have a child without this, it would certainly be better. But there are cases where all sorts of reasons it's not possible. This is one of those cases where you got to find who your rabbi is, and you have to go with that, because it really is across the board such a stressful and therefore confusing situation. So halachically, the question of motherhood is never was really considered, because it was like, what else do you, motherhood is what you think it means. What do you mean? What kind of question is that? If you'd asked somebody 100 years ago, what does it mean to a mother? They were like, what, they wouldn't understand the question. But with the brachas of modern technology, again, which have allowed all sorts of babies to be born that would not have otherwise been born, but has opened a little bit of a Pandora's box about how to halachically define motherhood. Emir Hashem, next week we will discuss not halacha, completely different type of sources, but more of a hashkafa perspective, and I as a man will tell you what it means to be a mother.